This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Now, the boss's chutzpah in fighting union organization legislation. For decades, employers have waged war on union organizing by firing workers, holding captive audience meetings to intimidate workers, and threatening to move their jobs overseas. Pro-union workers were fired in more than one quarter of union election campaigns.
Now that the Employee Free Choice Act, which would level the playing field for workers in organizing drives, is set for a congressional vote, the business lobby is working overtime to crush it. With us now to discuss the Employee Free Choice Act is Richard Trumka, Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, and John Schmidt, Senior Economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and author of the recent study, Dropping the Axe, Illegal Firings During Union Election Campaigns. But first, a business ad opposing the act.
Steel, auto, airlines. What do these industries all have in common? Hundreds of thousands of lost jobs and union bosses who helped to put them out of business. If you think the economy's bad now, it could get worse. Union bosses are pushing their own bailout bill in Congress that could force employees to pay union dues against their will. Economists say it will cost jobs and damage the economy. Fight the Employee Forced Choice Act at employeefreedom.org.
Well, there's no question that the employers, that businesses and corporations are putting a great deal of time, money, and energy into making sure that the Employee Free Choice Act never passes. I want to begin with our guest, Mr. Schmidt, and just find out a little bit more, give it a little greater context. So, dropping the axe, illegal firings during union elections, what are we really talking about? How bad are the statistics? Just to begin to put some meat on the bone for supporting the Employee Free Choice Act.
Well, thanks. Our report looks at the worst kind of offense that employers usually bring against workers, which is to fire selected workers that are involved in the organizing campaign. And that accomplishes two goals. It first, you know, can take the leadership out of a union campaign, and that can be a blow in and of itself. But then it also sends a message of fear to the rest of the workers involved that the employer can fire even, you know, the most prominent pro-union workers and get away with it because the law is so ineffective. But that's just the worst thing that happens. In about three-quarters of the cases when unions are involved, when workers are involved in trying to organize a union at their workplace, employers call in outside union avoidance consultants, otherwise known as union busters, that come in and use a really tried and well-established set of techniques that undermine both legal and illegally the ability of workers to organize a union. And one thing that the Employee Free Choice Act would do is make it much more difficult for employers to do that kind of behavior. It would increase substantially the penalties for those kinds of activities, and it would give workers a choice about exactly how they would be organized, whether using a secret ballot or whether they could be organized using a majority sign-up.
Richard Trumka, the majority of the criticism coming from the business community has to do with this majority sign-up provision, saying that this is anti-democratic. Do you want to comment on that and set the record straight?
Yeah, we sure do. You know, first of all, the Employee Free Choice Act puts the choice of how to form a union in the hands of workers. Currently, it's in the hands of employers, and they like it that way. But the law, you'll recall, was designed to protect and encourage the bargaining rights of individual workers, not the employers. So it puts it in the hands of workers, and a worker gets to decide whether you use majority sign-up or whether you go to an election. That choice, as I said, is currently in the hands of the corporations. Now, elections that they talk about may really sound like the most democratic approach, but the NLRB process is nothing like democratic elections in our society. Presidential elections, for example, because here one side has all the power. The employer controls the voter paychecks, their livelihood, has unlimited access to speak against the union in the workplace while restricting pro-union speech, and has the freedom to intimidate and coerce the voters, as Mr. Schmidt just told you, they use that freely. What could be more democratic than giving the worker the decision and the choice of how to select the union?
To follow up, what are the penalties under the current law for the employers who break the law?
No, they're woeful. In most cases, the penalty is they sign a piece of paper and they post it on a wall saying we won't do it again. In the cases where they fire somebody illegally, and by the way, the one out of four that John talked about really are the ones that got caught. There are others that don't get caught. And if you fire someone illegally during a drive, here's what you pay. It may take you 3 or 4 years to get your job back. And if you worked anywhere else or you had any kind of earnings, you deduct all of those earnings from what the employer would have to pay when they're ordered to put you back to work. So if you got another job and for some reason you got a nickel an hour more than what you were making at your old job where you were fired from, the employer would pay nothing in the process. The Employee Free Choice Act will strengthen those penalties and make it more than a cost of doing business. It'll make it more so they have to comply with the law.
I want to continue to put that meat on the bone and just give a sense of how difficult it is to organize a union, how discriminatory and how indeed violent it can become when employers seek to suppress labor's right to organize. So, John, why don't you give us another sense of some of the findings of your particular report? Because I know, for example, one thing is that more than one-fourth of all union representation elections in the 2000s have indeed been marred by illegal firing of pro-union workers. So what else is there to give us a sense of what we're really up against that requires the passage of this act?
Well, as Rich Trumka just said, I think it's important to emphasize that the cases that we looked at in our study were cases where employers agreed or were ordered to reinstate workers after they had filed a complaint with the NLRB that they had been fired illegally.
And we should just say, in case someone doesn't know, that's National Labor Relations Board.
Thank you. And as a result, I think that we're not quite talking about the tip of the iceberg because we're talking about one particular set of the worst kinds of violations that take place. But there are a lot of other kinds of things that can happen here. I think it's very important to understand the completely asymmetric power relationship here. Employers have a million ways that they control the day in and day out quality of life of workers, and they use that against them. For example, if an employer knows that you're in favor of the union, suddenly your access to overtime hours might disappear, or suddenly you might be scheduled to work on a Saturday when they know you have childcare responsibilities. There are a lot of things that employers can do along those lines that don't even rise to illegal activity, let alone activity that we can even monitor. So the imbalance here between the two sides is pretty terrific. And as a result, it makes it very difficult to talk about having a free and fair election along the lines of, I think, what most people have in our minds when we think about an election. And that's why I think it's so important to emphasize that what the Employee Free Choice Act would do is give the workers involved in the organizing campaign the right to choose how they choose whether to have a union or not. And that's the key issue. It makes it much more of a balanced operation than what we currently have.
Now, the employers have mounted a considerable offensive against the passage of this act with full-page ads in New York. We see it in the New York Times. I assume it's throughout other newspapers in the country, ads on radio and television. Richard, can you tell us what's behind this, what companies are behind it, what organizations are behind this, and what they're saying and what they're doing beyond that short ad that we played today?
Well, there are corporate front groups are really waging the major campaign to stop the Employee Free Choice Act because they don't want workers to have the freedom to choose for themselves whether to bargain through unions for better wages and benefits and working conditions. I'll give you an example. The anti-union network includes discredited groups like the Center for Union Facts. It's led by a lobbyist by the name of Richard Berman, who his son has even denounced what he's doing. He is infamous for fighting against things like the drunk driving laws, consumer and health protections, and then there's the National Right to Work Committee and Foundation. That's the country's oldest organization dedicated exclusively to destroying unions. The people that oppose the Employee Free Choice Act essentially are the companies and the Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, other groups like that that have opposed the minimum wage. They've opposed health and safety laws in the mines and in all of our workplaces through OSHA. They oppose the EEOC, the Equal Opportunity Employment Council. They oppose those type of things and anything else, quite frankly, that works to protect workers. They've opposed in the past. And they've used the Chicken Little approach like they're using right now, that if this happens, oh, the end of the world will come. Every time we've raised the minimum wage, the end of the economy will be here, and of course it never does. If you give people the right to not be discriminated against, the end of the world will come, and of course it never does. So they're saying that about the Employee Free Choice Act because, to quote one of them, one of the employers, they're in the driver's seat and they want to keep a hold of the steering wheel. They don't want the worker to have any rights.
But these are front groups. Who's funding the front groups? I know that Citibank held a conference call, and they, of course, are receiving TARP money. Who else is funding this?
Oh, just about all the groups, from the National Association of Manufacturers. Now, you have employer-friendly groups that generally aren't, but you have a group like the ADP. They do data processing. They sent things out to people. So it's a lot of the employers. They have no worker support. These are employers supporting and big corporations that do it. And, you know, the list could go on the rest of the night, quite frankly.
If I can jump in, I think there's an issue here that's important. Is there's a huge amount of class solidarity on the part of employers in this issue. It's not just the employers who think that they're going to face organizing campaigns that are supporting this. I think the employers understand something that progressives ought to understand, which is that if we have a resurgent labor movement that has a lot of economic clout in the economy, that is going to be good not just for the workers in those unions, but for workers outside of the unions, and much more importantly, I think in some ways, for building a progressive political climate in this country. Because the unions have been very supportive of a lot of the legislators and politicians in this country that are in favor of a whole host of issues that are important to progressives on the environment, on climate change, on energy, and on a whole lot of other issues like that. So I think that's something that the employers understand very well and are channeling money in that direction, even if they don't have direct interests themselves in terms of organizing at their workplaces.
And can they, if I may, they're going to raise about $200 million or better on this campaign to fight it. And I guess it would be important for us to say also who does support the Employee Free Choice Act. 73% of the American public supports the Employee Free Choice Act. It also has the support of hundreds of members of Congress on both sides of the aisle, academics and historians, civil and human rights organizations such as the NAACP and the Human Rights Watch. Most of the major faith denominations support it. All those people support it because they know it's important for working families because we're struggling so hard with wages dropping, health care costs rising, pensions disappearing. We're in danger of losing the middle class, and they know that under today's broken laws, working people are powerless to bargain for better wages while CEOs demand contracts for themselves and get golden parachutes for driving their companies into the ground. So this would level the playing field. And 73% of the American public supports it.
I just want to tackle one other issue that, frankly, has been the one that has been, I think, heard of most in the context of the employer propaganda that has been put out, and that is that the Employee Free Choice Act takes away workers' right to a secret ballot. They are spinning the table and making it look like they are the Democratic forces. So how do we answer that one?
Well, first of all, there's nothing that could be further from the truth. Under the current law, the worker can get majority or can get recognized by majority sign-up currently. But let me tell you how it works. I'll give you an example. Assume you have a unit of 100 workers, and all 100 workers sign a card and say, I want a union today. They go to the employer, and one of two things happens. The employer says, okay, in which case there's a union, and they start bargaining. Or the employer says, no way, I demand a secret ballot election, and all 100 workers who want a union have to go through the rigors and the tortures that you heard earlier about intimidations and then threats and being called into one-on-one sweat sessions with your boss and everything. The Employee Free Choice Act would change that to say it's the worker's choice. It's not the employer's choice. It's the worker's choice. They can choose one of two ways to have a union. They can say with majority sign-up, we want a union that way. Or they can say, no, we would like to have an election ourselves. But it switches it from the employer deciding that to the employee deciding that. And that's the way it was intended to be, and that's the way it was until not too long ago when the courts changed that. And I might add, 71 industrial countries around the world allow their workers to sign up and have a union by simply stating, signing a card and saying that's what we want. And in some cases, it only takes 5% of the workforce to get a union at that job site.
I just want to go back for a moment since John raised it, and that is the issue of placing this in the context of history, like in 1935 when we had the Wagner Act, which made it easier for workers to organize and establish the right to freedom of association and speech on the job. Give us a sense of what progressive legislation means for people organizing and what organizing means as good for workers, good for the economy.
I think if we want to get a feel for what kind of a difference the Employee Free Choice Act could make, I mean, we can look no further than what we have in terms of union organizing in the public sector in the United States. It's not exactly the same, but you have similar kind of a situation to what you might have after the Employee Free Choice Act, which is that the ability of employers to use a host of kind of ferocious legal and illegal tactics to resist unions won't be available to private sector employers. That's pretty much the situation we have in the public sector right now, where employers are in the public sector are much more restricted in terms of the kinds of actions they can take against workers. And if you look at the numbers, we have had about 35 to 40% of public sector workers in the United States in unions continuously from the end of the 1970s to the present. There hasn't been any decline in unionization, no shift away from the desire to have unions or taste for unions, the kind of crazy things I think that economists say sometimes. Whereas if you look in the private sector, we've seen a very steady decline from about a fourth of the private sector to only about 8% today. And that's the difference in the organizing environment in those two sectors, with otherwise plain old American workers in both contexts. And when they're given the choice to form a union in a reasonable way, they choose to form a union with much greater frequency than they do under the current law. Now, in terms of what kind of difference that can make over the long term, I think we have to look at countries that have a high level of unionization, and they have things like national health insurance. They have things like paid sick days, paid parental leave, paid vacation. And I think that is why employers across the board are so concerned about increasing unionization, not just because of the impact that it might have on their workplaces, but because it could really shift the balance of political power in this country.
So what's the website, Rich Trumka? How do we get on board?
Well, can I just respond also to the last question, because I really, really think it's important. An economy built on income inequality, where CEOs have all the power and working families do not share in the benefits of economic growth and don't have the money to spend or save, is an economy that can't succeed. And that's the problem we're seeing now, a consumer economy that's built on low wages and debt that is bound to fail. Now, there's not been greater income inequality between the wealthy and working families at any point since the Great Depression. When workers form unions, their jobs go from Walmart jobs to middle class supporting jobs with health care and retirement security. Union workers earn 28% more than their non-union counterparts, and they're 52% more likely to have job-provided health care. So the years of deregulation and privatization and anti-union forces have created the mess that we're in right now. And academics and economists agree that unions will help strengthen the middle class, which is good for our economy and good for our country. Unions will put money in workers' pockets, so the Employee Free Choice Act will help grow the economy, and it'll help close the gap between the very wealthy and the rest of us. That's what's at stake. We can turn low-class jobs that pay no benefits into middle-class producing jobs when this is over. And that is, to us, one of the most important benefits of the Employee Free Choice Act.
And, John Schmidt, where can people get the report?
At CEPR.net, Center for Economic and Policy Research.net. Yep.
And Rich Trumka, how can we find out more about the Employee Free Choice Act and how we can support it?
www.aflcio.org.
I thank both of you very much. This is a critical piece of legislation that we must get through. Richard Trumka, Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, and John Schmidt, thank you both for being with us. We appreciate it completely.
Yep. Thanks for having us.
Corporate greed, it's caused a meltdown of our economy. Just look at the news or your retirement account. Now greedy CEOs want to prevent workers from joining unions to level the playing field. Their new scheme to keep wages low? Spreading lies about the Employee Free Choice Act. The truth is, the Employee Free Choice Act absolutely protects workers' right to choose a secret ballot election. But the choice would be the workers, not their bosses. That's the secret big business doesn't want you to know.
Back in 35, the unions were growing. They were working hard and singing union songs. Was a lot of realizing that good old organizing was the only way to make the union strong. The only way to make the union strong. Oh, the companies paid out starvation wages, and their cruelty and greed is quite well known. There was no law in the land that would lend a helping hand, and the workers had to do it on their own. Yes, they did. Oh, the workers had to do it on their own. Well, Franklin Roosevelt, he stepped out of the White House, and he said, I'll tell you what I'm gonna do. Oh, the country's on the mend, and the government's your friend, and the Wagner Act, it is the thing for you. Oh, the Wagner Act, it is the thing for you. So now the workers had a right to join a union, and this legislation seemed without a flaw. But standing in the foyers were 100,000 lawyers waiting for to tinker with the law. Lord, Lord, they were waiting for to tinker with the law. Oh, the sit-downs and boycotts and the walkouts kept the union movement growing fast. But the labor law kept changing, and all this rearranging, it was stripping away the weapons of our class. Lord, Lord, stripping away the weapons of our class. Oh, the list of rules and laws kept getting longer, and the government would go to any length to make up some amendment to keep us more dependent on the labor laws instead of on our strength. Lord, Lord, on the labor laws instead of on our strength. So when Ronald Reagan came into the White House, and he steered this country sharply to the right, by the time his big steamroller crushed the air traffic controllers, well, the unions had forgotten how to fight. Lord, Lord, the unions had forgotten how to fight. So you want to pass another law to save the unions, and you say this bill is fair and just and wise. Well, that that is fine and dandy, but something much more handy would be if once more we learned organize, Lord, Lord. If once more we learned organize, because the union strength is in its independence, and the laws are made to keep us all at bay. So kick your leaders in their asses, let's organize the masses. That's the only way we'll win the day, Lord, Lord. That's the only way we'll win the day. That's the only way we'll win the day, Lord, Lord. That's the only way we'll win the day.
The Battle of Labor Law Reform, written and performed by John O'Connor.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
buildingbridgesradio.org.